This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to the fourth in the fall colloquium series of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I'm Michael Nacht, interim director of the center. It's a great opportunity to introduce my colleague and next-door neighbor at Goldman, Jesse Rothstein. Before I do, just one bit of coming attractions. The next colloquium is next Tuesday, the 18th of March, and it's kind of a special treat. It's California State Senators Lonnie Hancock and Carol Liu, and the subject is public universities and the legislative process. So it's kind of quite important to our livelihood. So you really might want to come. That will be held at the Social Science Matrix. It's the eighth floor of Barrows. And it's also not at a normal time. It's 3 to 4. So to summarize, next Tuesday, 3 to 4, Barrows, Public Research Universities and the Legislative Process. Okay. And Cal Christ, our provost and executive vice chancellor, will be hosting. So today we're going to hear from Jesse Rothstein, who's a very distinguished economist and public policy analyst. Jesse graduated from Harvard with honors in mathematics, did his master's in public policy at the Goldman School, and received his PhD in economics from Berkeley. He taught for a number of years at Princeton in the economics and Woodrow Wilson schools. And then he went on leave into the Obama administration, where he was a senior economist for the Council of Economic Advisors and then chief economist for the Department of Labor. We were fortunate to recruit him back after he finished all of that. And Jesse has multiple hats at Berkeley. He's a professor of public policy. He's a professor in the economics department. And he is the director of the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, which is a major research center that's been here for decades. More recently, Jesse was asked by Kathy Koshlin to do a study on the impact of changing processes on the undergraduate admissions process. And it's really caused a lot of eyes to open about things that are happening there. It's obviously a very important subject for Berkeley, for our undergraduate students. So we're going to hear about that today from Jesse. Please welcome Jesse Rothstein.
Thank you. Wow. Okay. Thanks a lot. It looks like there are a couple seats up here for those who are stuck without them, but maybe not. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for having me. As Michael said, this has an unusual genesis for one of my projects. This was not, hey, somebody ought to write a paper on this. Why don't I write a paper on this and go work for 2 years on it? This was Kathy Koshlin called me in June and said, we need you to write a memo for us in 2 weeks. And I said, how soon can you get me the data? And they said, well, about a week and a half. And so I didn't get them the memo quite as fast as they wanted. But this was a pretty quick project, and I think it was pretty interesting. And planning on continuing the work over the next year. And so I'm very interested in people's comments and feedback for that part of it especially. Okay, so let me just jump in. So the backdrop of this is trying to connect this to the literature, which would have been the motivation had I started with this as the literature as motivation, is that in admissions, there are two kinds of information we have that we're thinking about in admissions. One is just the numbers. We've got SAT scores, we've got high school grades, we've got number of AP courses, we've got various other things that we can write down as numbers. And we could just run our admissions by taking some weighted average of those things or some formula depending on those things and just make decisions based on that. And in fact, for a long time, that was more or less how Berkeley and most of the UCs ran their admissions, for most of the admissions. And for those of us who study admissions, that's at least those of us who are quantitative and study admissions, that's what we do, because we do. I can't put a letter of recommendation into a regression. And so I stick to the numeric variables, and you have studies about what information the SAT tells you. But in practice, if you look at admissions processes, almost everywhere, almost every highly selective college, including now the UCs, they're using lots of things that are not so easily quantified. Things like essays, things like letters of recommendation. our holistic review process is something like that. The readers are trying to get some broad sense of the whole application without that's not a, simply a weighted average of each of the quantitative measures. And all of these are using qualitative information. And those of us who are quant geeks don't really understand how this plays into things. Like I think it's an interesting question. What information are we getting out of all this quantitative information? How much is it improving the decisions? And is it actually improving them, or is it making them worse? There are lots of situations where if you ask somebody to make a judgment, they will form a judgment, and they'll be very confident in that judgment, but their judgment will be worse than you could have accomplished with just a simple quantitative average. And so it's not so clear that just because we think that we're adding value by looking at these things, that we actually are. And so I think those of us who are interested in this really want to know, are we learning more about academic preparedness? We know that the SAT is very limited. We know that high school grades are very limited. If we ask for an essay and we read it and try to assess, is this somebody who's ready for the university, is that helping us? Are we doing a better job of assessing academic preparedness? We might be. On the other hand, this kid's mother might have written the essay, so we might be doing a worse job. We might be looking at other dimensions of preparedness. So it might be we're not actually interested in the academic piece, but we want something more than just academic preparedness. We want a well-rounded class in various other ways. We want people who are going to go save the world. You can't tell that from their SAT score, but you might be able to tell that from their essay. And so we might be getting useful information there. And then another possibility is that we might just be fuzzing up the process. And that actually, given the jurisprudence in this area, that might be a desirable trait, if you can just add deniability to the decisions, that may be one of the roles that this kind of information is playing. And so those are, I think, interesting questions that I would really like to know more about. Turns out that Berkeley gives us a nice natural experiment for this. This is not, I think, wasn't really what was intended, but what actually happened. So over time, Berkeley has become much more selective. At this point, less than 20% of students who apply are admitted. That's down quite a lot from what it used to be. That's mostly because every selective university has gotten much more selective over time. But in any case, it is. And the quantitative measures we have, I think you can make a reasonable argument that they're just not so useful when you're making distinctions up that high in the distribution. To make the kind of reductio of this is that in graduate economics admissions, until recently when they rescaled the GRE, we wouldn't look at anybody who didn't have a perfect score on the math GRE. Because 6% of applicants had a perfect score on the math GRE, and we didn't admit that many applicants. 6% of test takers got it, and out of people who were applying to econ programs, it was much more than that. And so we just wouldn't even look at somebody who got a 179 instead of a 180. That's crazy. On the other hand, it's not so clear. Well, it's crazy for two reasons. One, it's crazy because it means that this measure is totally useless. But it's also not so clear that a 179 and a 180 are meaningfully different from each other. And so we really need more textured information if you're going to try to make these very, very fine distinctions. You know, another version of this is people talk about how Harvard could admit a class of all valedictorians several times over. You're going to need more than just whether somebody's a valedictorian to make these decisions. So in any case, relatively recently, the Senate Committee on Admissions, Enrollment, and Preparatory Education, AEPE, decided that the way to do a better job is we should start asking for letters of recommendation. That would give us some texture that we don't really have otherwise. And we should start using that in admissions. And if we're going to only admit 20%, we're not going to be able to make informed decisions without some more qualitative information like that. This was not happily welcomed by the powers that be within the UC for kind of two reasons. One is the stated reason is there's a concern, and I think it's a legitimate concern, that students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds might have trouble getting good letters. That if your family knows Senator Feinstein, you'll get a letter from Senator Feinstein and you'll get in. And if you go to a school where there isn't a guidance counselor or where there's a counselor who's responsible for 3,000 students, you might have trouble getting somebody who can even write you a letter. And if you get a letter, it won't be a very good letter. And so this might kind of advantage the advantaged. That's one reason. Another concern is that changes that we make here tend to bleed over to the other UCs. And if it might not be so bad for Berkeley to start asking for letters of recommendation, because most of the people who are applying to Berkeley are already applying to private colleges anyway that also require letters. And so the marginal cost to get in, get having your letters sent to one more place is pretty low. But if Riverside started asking for letters, most of their applicants are not getting letters of recommendation sent anywhere. And so we would be creating an enormous unfunded mandate for the state's guidance counselors if all of the UCs started asking for letters. So that was part of the resistance. In any case, the system didn't like it. And so we were told, no, you can't ask for letters. And we worked out, and then there was a fight about who actually has the authority to make these decisions. And we wound up with a resolution, which is in fall, for the people who applied in fall 25, who started school here about a month ago. The way it worked is that people applied without letters of recommendation, and the applications were going to be scored initially. And they were scored into yes, no, or maybe. And the idea was, we don't need letters from everybody. We only need letters from people for whom the other information isn't enough to lead to a firm decision. So after we get that scoring, we're going to go ask the maybes for letters. Okay? Which is a weird process. I think it probably made it much more costly for the state's guidance counselors. Because instead of being asked for letters when people were submitting their applications, they were asked in January when they thought the nightmare of admission season was over. But in any case, they were asked to do that, and we hoped that they had already written them and they could just upload them. And then we do two reads for each of these applications, and the second read we get to look at the letters if we have them. Okay. Now, part of the compromise was that some of the students who were asked for letters didn't submit them, and then we would read the application without letters, and we would try not to pay attention to the fact that they failed to submit letters and try not to penalize people for that. But so you weren't ruled out if you didn't have letters. It wasn't a requirement, but you were strongly encouraged. Okay? And so what I'm going to do what I'm going to present here and what I tried to do this summer is try to use this to understand what was the impact of letters. How did they change the decisions? And so the basic question is, how did the request for letters influence the admissions decisions? One possibility is that it disadvantages the people who are already disadvantaged because we asked them for letters, they couldn't get them, or they could only get bad ones. And we didn't let them in, but we would have let them in if we hadn't had letters from them. Another possibility is that there are students who just didn't look very good on the numbers, but actually were strong enough for us to want them. And the letters gave them a chance to show that. So it could go either way, what the net impact of this is. So that's what I tried to answer this summer. What I think the really interesting questions are what is the information that the letters are providing? If we conclude that the letters are actually changing decisions, what about the letters is changing decisions? Is it whether Senator Feinstein wrote it or whether somebody we'd never heard of wrote it? Is it the length of the letter? Is it how much personal texture there is? Or is it the number of grammar errors in the letter that influenced the decision? I think for those of us who are really quant geeks, it's really interesting to understand how this qualitative information affects the process and what aspect of it does. And it's true beyond just looking at college admissions. What do cover letters do in job applications? What do references do? What is the information here? There's been a long-standing concern that a lot of these things amount to old boys networks that allow people to allow people who have stronger connections to do better. And I think there's an opportunity to learn that from, at least in this area, from this. So that's what I want to get at. And then another question I want to get at is we're going to find that some people who would have been admitted without letters were not admitted because of the letters. And potentially we may find that people who wouldn't have been admitted without letters were admitted because of the letters. Maybe I just said the same thing twice, but both letters can improve somebody's decision or hurt their decision. Are the people who are pulled in the people we want to be pulling in, or are the people who are pushed out the people we want to be pushing out? I think we want to be agnostic about whether this actually led to better decisions, even if we can find that it led to different decisions. Now, the only way to assess that is to have some measure of whether it was a good decision or not. And the conventional way of doing this is to look at first-year grades, not because first-year grades are a perfect measure, but because we're impatient. And we don't want to wait to see whether people graduate or wait to see whether they go save the world. And so in a year, we'll be able to look at this class's actual results as first-year students. And in 2 years, we'll be able to look at the next class's results as first-year students. And then we can kind of see whether the decisions we made with these letters are better or not. And that'll be down the road. Let me get into this one. Now, what makes this challenging is that Berkeley changed everything in 2016 or 2015. It's not just that they added letters. They also eliminated something called augmented review, which was a special kind of program where some applications were pulled out for extra consideration of people, essentially of students who we thought were especially disadvantaged and might not be treated fairly by the normal process. Those students were actually asked for letters even before. So this isn't totally unprecedented to ask for letters. But it was a much smaller share of the applicants. Another thing we did is we used to score people on roughly a 5-point scale. When we read the applications, the readers would give it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I think that the judgment was made that that was leading people to make fine distinctions that didn't matter. And so they switched to a yes, no, maybe decision scoring, with the idea that if somebody's a no, we don't need to know whether they're a real absolutely no or just no. Either way, they're not getting in. And if somebody's a yes, we don't need to know where they are in the ranking of yeses. We just need to know they are getting in. And so I think the thought was that by using this scoring system, they would focus people's attention on the decisions that mattered. We also added scoring, a separate quantitative scoring on holistic or non-cognitive factors. People were, in addition to being asked to assess yes, no, maybe, they were also asked to assess, I think it was 10 different non-cognitive factors and whether the applicants showed strength in that. Another change is that where in the past we'd read some applications only once and then decided this decision is clear, we read every single application twice. Sometimes three times, because we also added faculty readers last year, where in the past we had just left it all to admissions. Another piece of it is the admit rate went up last year. In the past, the previous year we admitted 18.8, we admitted 21.1. That's going to lead to changes in outcomes just because we, in some sense, have a lower bar. And it doesn't look like that we to me at least, in looking at the data, it doesn't look like we raised the admit rate because we got stronger applicants and we kind of got confused and accidentally admitted too many. The strength of the applicants was pretty similar. We just admitted more students. And that's going to have impacts on all sorts of outcomes. And then another change that I actually concluded is going to be pretty important to the analysis I do is we use the wait list a lot more. So in the previous year, 4.5% of applicants had been offered a spot on the wait list rather than being just initially admitted or denied. This cycle, almost twice as many were, 8.6%. Why is that important? Well, it's going to make it very hard to measure outcomes in a comparable way. There are lots of students who we offered a spot on the wait list, and if they had accepted that spot on the wait list, we would have eventually admitted them. But a lot of them said, no, I don't want the spot on the wait list. I already got admitted somewhere else. I'm going to go there. And so we count them as not admits. But if we hadn't used the wait list, we would have just admitted them outright. And so we would have counted them as admits. So the way we're measuring outcomes, there's no purely comparable way of measuring outcomes this year relative to last year. That's going to be an issue. Okay, I'm going to focus on just the letters of recommendation and try to isolate the impact of the other things as best I can. Most of them I can isolate. These ones are going to be harder, but we'll try. Okay. So just to give you a sense of the overall picture, roughly 80,000 students apply to Berkeley every year. 80,000. So clearly it's going to be an enormous process to do this, and most of the decisions are going to have to be made fairly quickly. Of those 80,000, we admit about 14,000, between 13 and 14. And again, we admitted about 1,000 more this past year than the year before that. The admission rate went up a little bit. Of the 80,000, about 45,000 are California residents. By the way, I'm excluding recruited athletes from everything I show you. They are admitted under different processes, and let's not go there. Okay. And of the California residents, about 20% are admitted. And again, that went up. Okay? Historically, we've looked at four different measures of underrepresented groups to try to track whether the process is kind of working fairly. One is we can look at whether the family income is below 40,000. And about 30% of applicants are in that category. For all of these groups, the share of admits in the category is going to be lower than the share of applicants. Right, because on average, students from these disadvantaged backgrounds tend to be less strong applicants. Not all of them. There's a range in each, but on average, they tend to be lower. And so we don't admit we admit some, but not all of them, and a lower proportion than we do for non underrepresented groups. Another measure is: are you the first generation in your family to go to college? Are you from a school that has a low academic performance index, which is supposed to be a measure of how well-run the school is, but is in practice a measure of the demographics of the school? And then, are you an underrepresented minority? And so I'm going to focus for most of what I do on whether you're in any one of these four without distinguishing them. For some purposes, it's important to distinguish them because three of these were allowed to consider it in admissions and the fourth one were not. But for my purposes, in just asking what happened, I'm just going to pool them all together. And so about half of our applicants are from that category, from one of those four categories, and 40% of our admits. Now, that is also remarkable. I've done others, you know, I taught at Princeton for a while. I looked at some of their data. They don't have 40% of their applicants or their admits from these categories. There are very few selective universities that are able to do this, and I think actually there's one. Okay, so how am I going to go about this? It's useful to kind of try to distinguish between the applicants who are in the money and the ones who aren't, right? That we get a lot of applicants who just they applied, they went through the, you know, they were probably not ever expecting to come here, but it turns out to apply to Berkeley. Once you're already applying to Riverside, you just have to check one more box and pay a few more dollars. And so we get a lot of people who are applying here just because they might as well. And in general, in admissions, you have a lot of people who are applying with very low chances. And so it's useful to try to distinguish how good somebody's chances are. And so what I'm going to do is do something that the admissions office does, which is take all the quantitative measures that we can code up and put into a statistical analysis package and use them in 2015 data to predict which applicants were given first-round admissions offers. They were just admitted. They weren't offered the wait list. We just said, yes, we want you. Okay? And so for each applicant in 2015, I can give a probability. Given your numbers, what's the chance you would have gotten a first-round admissions offer? So I'll do that. And I can do that for the 2016 applicants also. And when I do that for the 2016 applicants, I can't see what they actually... Well, I'm not using what actually happened to them. I'm just using what I would have predicted would have happened to them given the way we ran admissions in 2015. And I'm going to construct this I'm going to call it an admission score, which ranges from 0 for the people who I can tell by the numbers there's no chance they would have been admitted in 2015, up to 1, which is the people who had 100% chance of being admitted. Okay? And I'm just going to use that to organize things and to kind of help get a sense of things. So here's what the distributions look like. I've got the distribution for applicants and the distribution for admitted students. What you see is that the vast majority of our applicants have extremely low admission scores. Most of our applicants are totally out of the money. Now, some of these people with admission scores between 0 and 0.02, so we would have predicted there's a 1% chance they would have been admitted. Some of them actually were admitted, but not very many of them. So a much larger share of our admits than of our applicants come from these people who have very strong numbers, because people with these very strong numbers are admitted with high probabilities. And so this is the distribution of people of actual admits. Okay? What this basically says is we can't do a perfect job of predicting admissions. If we could do a perfect job of predicting admissions, everybody who is admitted would have a score of 1. But we can do a pretty good job of identifying people who have very low chances of being admitted. And it's kind of they're going to fuzz things up, and so it's going to be useful to kind of not to pay too much attention to them. Okay. The other thing you can do is look at who was asked for letters of recommendation. And so what I'm doing is, for all applicants, I've got the admission score, and this dotted line is the share of them who are asked for letters of recommendation. And what you can see is that overall, a pretty large share, well, if you have admission scores of above about 0.3, there's something like a 60% chance or more 60% chance of being asked for letters. So a pretty large share of them were asked for letters. Until you get up to the very, very stars, where again, remember, we were only asking for letters from the maybes, not the yeses or the noes. So these guys are the yeses. We knew based on the first read we were going to admit them, so we didn't bother to ask them for letters. So these guys, only a third of them were asked for letters. But through the middle of the distribution, the share asked for letters was pretty high. On the other hand, almost all of our applicants are over here. And for the people over here, 10% of them were asked for letters. Now, does that mean we weren't giving them a chance that we should have given them? I don't know. Most of these were pretty far out of the money. It's not so clear it's worth putting the time into reading letters for if you're going to get 40,000 applicants and you have somebody who, based on the numbers, it's clear they're not going to make it. It's not so clear. If you do this for underrepresented groups, you get a pretty similar pattern. Right? I'm also showing you here the share of students who are considered under augmented review in 2015, which was the other way we tried to bring in kind of more qualitative information. And what you can see is the letters of recommendation program was an order of magnitude larger than the augmented review program, which was a very small share of our applicants. Okay, that there's no point where basically more than 10 or 20% of applicants were considered under augmented review. Okay. So overall, we asked about 14,000 students for letters of recommendation. This is all of our in-state applicants. It's about a third of our applicants. So even though it looks like it averages about 50, 60%, so many of our applicants are over here that it's only about a third. And among underrepresented groups, we asked about 6,000 for letters, or about a quarter of the applicants. Turns out the way we did it, we can track whether they asked somebody for letters, because the way we did it mechanically is we asked them to type in the email addresses of people who should be asked for letters, and then those people would get an automated email asking them to upload it. Greg, correct me if I get any of this wrong, but I think this is right. Okay, so of the people who were asked, 88% of all applicants and about 85% of the underrepresented applicants actually asked somebody for letters. A slightly lower share asked for two letters, which is what we were hoping they would do. Some just asked one person for letters. And then almost everybody who asked for letters got at least one in. Right? And so about 73% got two letters, slightly lower for the underrepresented groups. But that's pretty close to the request numbers. So it looks like what happened is some of the students who were asked for letters just never bothered to put in anybody's address. We don't know whether that's because they didn't have anybody who they knew who would write them a letter, and so they didn't have an address to put in, or whether it's or because they just knew they already knew at that point they'd gotten in early decision somewhere else and they just weren't interested. But for whatever reason, some of them don't request letters, but then once they request letters, we get the letters with a pretty high probability. So almost everybody who was asked actually returned them. The other thing you can notice is that these numbers are a little bit different, but they're not that much different. It doesn't look like our underrepresented students had a dramatically harder time identifying people to get letters from than the non-underrepresented applicants. Okay, and then outcomes, 40% of them were initially admitted, basically admitted in the first round. Another 19% were offered a spot on the wait list, of which a good chunk of them said no. In order to be off, when you were offered a spot on the wait list, you then had to click, say, yes, I want to be on the wait list. And some of the people who were offered said no. Again, that's probably because they'd already been admitted somewhere else, and they knew that they didn't think it was worth the trouble. In any case, if you add up the people who were admitted initially and then the ones who were eventually admitted off the wait list, 46% were. And again, it's slightly lower for the underrepresented groups. Okay, so let's get into how the letter of recommendations were requested. It's a completely cockamamie way of doing it, which turned out to be extremely useful for trying to study the program. So, for those of you who are economists or talk to economists, this is the most beautiful regression discontinuity you'll ever see. Okay? So what did we do? The idea was we were going to read each application once, score them as yes, no, maybe, and ask the maybes for letters. But when you have 40,000 applicants, it's hard to read them all once. It takes time. And we knew the longer we waited to ask for letters, the harder it would be to get them back in time. And so we tried to speed up the process. And again, I was not at all part of this, so I wasn't part of these discussions. This is all what I've learned after the fact. But it seems like a reasonable approach. What they did is they said, let's figure out a mechanical way to figure out who are the maybes. Let's use the 2015 data to predict what the read score would have been if we had read them according to the way we read them in 2015. So we're going to use the 2015 data, regress the read score on all the quantitative measures we have, and generate a predicted read score. And we're going to classify those predicted read scores into yes, no, maybe. And if somebody got a maybe on that, we're going to ask them for letters, even if we haven't gotten around to reading their application yet. So there are two ways to get asked for a letter. One is to get read and get a maybe. And the other one is for this basically a weighted average of your numbers to say, you look like a maybe, we're going to ask you for letters also. And in practice, 80% of the letter recommendation requests came from this second method, this mechanical method. Okay, and 40% of them came from the other approach, and there were some people who got identified by both of them. They only got asked once, but. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, here's the predicted read score we generated from them based on the 2015 data and their numbers. And we scored them on a 1 to 5 scale. And the actual scoring was, we didn't give somebody a 1.732. We gave them a round number for the most part. But if we're generating a predicted score out of a regression, a predicted score out of a regression is not a round number. It's going to be continuous. And we had a lot of X's in this, so it really is a continuously distributed variable. But then we had to classify those predicted scores into yes, no, maybe. And so we said that everybody who is between this line and this line, we're going to call a maybe. What that means is that there are people who had a predicted Reed score of, you know, right here, just to the left of this line. If their numbers gave them that, they got asked for a letter with probability 1. On the other hand, if their predicted Reed score was just a little bit worse, maybe they had 10 less points on the SAT or 0.01 lower high school GPA, they wound up with a predicted Reed score over here, and there was only a 25% chance they would be asked for letters, and that happened because somebody actually read their application and called them a maybe. And so we're going to get this enormous contrast in the way people are treated based on this pretty arbitrary distinction about which side of the line they fell. That's a regression discontinuity. We can then compare the admissions outcomes for the people right here and the people right here and ask and infer that if they are different, that must be because they were treated differently in the letters process, because in every other way they're the same. Right? If you were looking at their applications, you wouldn't be able to tell which side of the line they were on without going through a lot of trouble to average these 100 different variables that were used to construct the score. Okay, and then the same thing here. And the way the scores were done, lower numbers are better. So these are our really strongest applicants. And then these are the weaker applicants. Okay, so we're going to be able to actually do two regression discontinuities. One is the people who are on the threshold between yes and maybe. So these are pretty strong applicants. If they were a little bit weaker than this line, they got asked for letters automatically. And if they were a little bit stronger, they only got asked for letters with about a 50% chance. And so these are marginal, but on the strong side of marginal. And then these are marginal, but on the weak side of marginal. These are people who, if they were on this side, they were asked for letters. If this side, they weren't. But their admission chances were quite a bit lower. Okay, and then you can look at what the actual outcomes were. And again, because we changed the process, there's no single summary of what the outcomes were. So I'm going to show four here. The top, this bottom line, no, this second line, this line here, this is the share of applicants at each point who were initially admitted. The line above that is the people who are admitted or offered a spot on the wait list, and the one in between is the ones who were ever admitted. And then this bottom ones is the ones who actually registered. So admitted and said yes. And what we're looking for is signs that these lines are discontinuous at these two vertical lines. And what you can see is that if you look at the points around this line, the admissions outcomes are all better for the people to the left of this line than the people to the right of this line. Well, people to the left of this line, about half of them were asked for letters of recommendation. People to the right, all of them were asked for letters of recommendation. And there are basically no other differences between them. So what this is saying is being asked for letters, moving from this side to this side, hurts your chances of getting in if you're one of these people. Okay? Over here, it's harder to see a discontinuity. But if anything, it jumps up as you go in. And what this is saying is for these people, being asked for letters helps your chances. Now, I think this is exactly what should have happened. Right? These are people who, if we didn't have letters, we were going to let them in anyway with a pretty high probability. So the only thing you can do, if we have somebody who's basically going to get in, the only thing a letter can do is hurt them. Right? This is a binary decision. If you're already a yes, a very strong letter can't make it any more of a yes. All it can do is turn you into a no. On the other hand, these people, they only had about less than a 50% chance they were going to get in. For them, a strong letter could help them. But a weak letter probably wasn't going to hurt them because they probably weren't going to get in anyway. And so I think what we should expect is that for people on the kind of low side, a letter should help them. For people on the high side, letters on average should hurt them. Not that it hurts all of them, but that's the only thing it can do to them. And so some of them it hurts and others it has no effect, and the average is it hurts them. And so that's going to be the conclusion, is that if you take all of our applicants being asked for letters, and you focus only on the people who are on the threshold between maybe and yes, being asked for letters reduced their chances of getting in by about 10 percentage points. So that's a pretty sharp reduction on an average of around, I don't know, about 80%. On the other hand, if you look at people who are on the threshold between no and maybe, being asked for letters raised their chances of being admitted by about 2 to 4 percentage points, depending on how you measure it. Again, for people who have an admission chance of under a half. Okay? If you do the same thing for underrepresented applicants, well, for one thing, we have less data, so everything is noisier. But if anything, it looks like this negative effect of being asked for letters for the strongest applicants, there's no sign of it here. Maybe there's still a positive effect over here, but there's no negative effect here. And so for underrepresented applicants, it looks like it had less of an effect. Okay, if anything, it looks like the letters that were more positive across the board for the underrepresented students than for everybody else. And so what I conclude based on this is that being asked for letters did change decisions. It reduced our chances of admitting the people with the strongest numbers, and it raised our chances of admitting people with somewhat weaker numbers. And it didn't have any differential negative effect on underrepresented applicants. Right? It could have, but it doesn't seem to have. Okay? Now, this is what we want letters to do. If we wanted to admit the people with the strongest numbers, we don't need letters. The whole point is to say no to some of the people who have really strong numbers but are actually not that good, and say yes to the people who have weaker numbers who are that good. So I think, as best we can tell, this is exactly consistent with the intent of the letters. And it doesn't seem to have had a differential effect on underrepresented students. Now, it's consistent with that, doesn't mean it worked. For it to work, we would want to know the people we got to let in or the people we wanted to let in. We don't know that yet. We want them to be somehow better. So we're going to have to wait until we can see outcomes for these people to see whether the people who we brought in through this process were actually better than the people who we pushed out through the process. But it's consistent. Everything we have so far is consistent with the original intent. Okay. So now, turns out we're still fighting over whether we can do this again. We're still arguing about it. And so that's good or bad. I think there are arguments on both sides. But we still want to know what happened. And you can learn more if you get at it ahead of time than if you have to come after the fact. And so what we're going to try to do is in this cycle, we're going to try to study this a little bit better. One of the nice things about being brought in last June rather than this coming June is I actually can be part of the process and kind of see what's happening rather than come in after all the decisions are made. And so we're at least in conversations about trying to design a study for this coming year, and I'd love people's feedback on this. And so what I want to know is, what is the effect of letters of recommendation? How does it vary for applicants of different types, including underrepresented groups? And what I'm really interested in is, what are the readers picking up from the letters? What aspect of the letter is leading a reader to say, yes, I want to admit this student even though I wouldn't have otherwise? Or no, this student looked good on paper, but actually they're not so good. And then do letters lead to better decisions? And so what I think we're leaning towards is, we can't interfere with the actual process. The process has to be a well-oiled machine if you're ever going to get through 40,000 applicants. But what we're going to do is, the people who are hired to read applications, I think what we're going to try to do is pay them to stay on a little bit longer and read some more applications, just what they always wanted to do, right? Read some more applications, but what we can do after the process is done is we can monkey with what information they have. So we're going to take an applicant who actually submitted letters of recommendation and then read the application again without the letters, and compare the score that the reader gave without the letters to the score that some other reader gave with the letters. Can't use the same reader, or they might remember what they did. And ask whether, you know, then we may be able to identify students who were helped by their letters and other students who were hurt by their letters. And then code the letters. And this is going to be the hardest part. But I think one is, we can code, do you actually have letters? Another is, we can try to code up who sent the letter. Is this somebody who has sent lots of letters to us or not so many? What kind of school you're from? Things like that. And then what I would like to do, but this is beyond my skill set, so we're going to have to figure this out, is try to do kind of some automated content analysis of the letters. Like, there are easy things. We could just measure the length of the letter. But there are also tools to do kind of sentiment analysis of text. And so if this is an effusive letter, does that help? Or if there's lots of I's in the letter versus he or she, does that affect things? I'd love, you know, another version is we could go through and read them and try to code them ourselves and try to figure out how to code them. And that may be a way to pursue it further. Other pieces of this, I think we're going to need to track what happens at other UCs. That's going to be a challenge, but I think it's worth doing because of this issue that the people who we admit and then go somewhere else, we lose. This will help with some of the selection. And then I think we want to follow people up and see how they do, because that'll help us measure whether things went well, whether the people we brought in with this process are better than the people who we didn't, who we pushed out. Okay, so I'm over time, so I think I should stop here. But I would love any questions, and then if anybody has suggestions about how to do this study, I'm all ears, because I think there's a real opportunity here. Okay.
Thanks, Jesse. I'll also, in full disclosure, my name is Greg Dubrow. I work in the Office of Undergraduate Admissions. I helped supply Jesse
with
a lot of the data. And just maybe this will help guide some future questions. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things about the letters. We did have a worry about maybe some students from under-resourced schools, but it wasn't so much that they wouldn't have access to people like Dianne Feinstein. In fact, Susan can back me up. deliberately would say, those letters aren't the ones that help us. A, we required one letter to be from a teacher in an academic subject. Mm-hmm. And B, it could be somebody else who knew them well. And we put in the FAQs, don't give us a letter from Dianne Feinstein if she doesn't know you that well. Mm-hmm. So you know, the effect of that would be muted. So
I think the concern would be the people who do know her.
Right, but yeah, but if the teacher, yeah. know, if the teacher's yeah. rec was, you know, so it would right. only go so far in that thing.
Yep.
And you made a point about the students who didn't request. We did find a pretty high correlation between students who withdrew their applications in January citing early admissions and not requesting letters.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that came out. And our admit rate, of course, went up because of the enrollment target increases. So there's some really, and that also drove the waitlist increase. So just yeah. clarifying some points in case other people had some questions about that.
And yeah, thank you.
And maybe the negative effect of letters, I would just say that because those students and the high maybe, the things that tend to distinguish on the admits are the extracurriculars and the personal statements, the things that I couldn't quantify in my REIT score model, you know.
Again, that's what we're trying to do with these
right,
letters.
And that's one of those, you know, for noise in the model, that might be a thing. So I just mm-hmm. wanted to, just some clarifications on that. But otherwise, enjoyed the presentation, enjoyed
Thank
the
you.
Study.
Thank you. Yeah, and I should say, Greg actually figured this stuff out beforehand. I only got to look at it after the fact and then had to guess about what had happened and without any time to figure it out. So, but I appreciate all your help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought I heard you say at the beginning that you were going to relate the admitted class of 2015 to grades they got at Cal to try and look at what the outcome was. And if that hasn't happened yet, when do you expect that to happen? And the second question is, suppose the grades weren't so great, but they create a new business called Federal Express.
Okay. Let me take the first one. This change was made for the decisions that were made in fall 2015 for students who started here about a month ago. So eventually I want to look at grades, but I don't have my grades in for the semester yet. So it's going to take a little while. As for other things that are that's exactly what we're trying to look for. So I think what you meant by created Federal Express is not did we create a lot of business for FedEx because everybody had to send their letters here. They didn't. We uploaded electronically. But did somebody do something really impressive that's not captured by the quantitative measures? That's what we want to. That's the reason to gather this qualitative information. And so I think that's why you want it. And maybe it, and the question is did we succeed at that? I don't know who has the mic. You have the mic. Great.
Okay. I may have missed this, but I was wondering, did you get a difference in the letter submission rate as a function of the API school's score?
So I didn't look at that, but you looked at that, and not much.
It was pretty high. Of the students who requested, and Jesse's percentages there were all among all students who we asked, but of the students who we actually requested, the receiving at least one letter, those rates were in the 90s. And again, slight differences, 1 or 2%, but within kind of error, where you could tolerate for error.
Yeah, so it looks like there, you know, you can see here there's a slight difference in the chance of being, of asking somebody for letters based on measures of disadvantage, where API is one of them. But once you ask somebody for letters, there's basically no difference in the chance that they actually produce them, which is interesting.
So I have a question about the fact that you will be looking at 2017 in real time. And
uh-huh.
What effect do you think your experiment or your research will have on the actual process? And how might it be damaged in a way or influenced, especially if people know what your hypotheses are or some of the things that you might be concerned about? And how will that influence readers and others in admissions?
Yeah.
Do you have any concern about that?
I do, and as you asked that, I realized I should have asked if there are any application readers in the audience and asked them to cover their ears. We're not going to interfere with any of the actual processes. Everything, every intervention is going to be after the decisions are made. So people might, you know, I might have some impact by telling people that, oh, by the way, we're going to pay you for another month of work, but I hope that doesn't have a big impact. And it's true that knowing that I'm studying things could change what people do. I think that would be true whether or not I was doing a study, because everybody knows that this is a hot issue and that the study was going to happen. But
Yeah, but knowing that you'll have access to read scores, for example, and that you can scrutinize it may change the behavior of individuals.
Could be. I mean, I think we'll...
Maybe for the better, but...
What we're going to need to do is code things so that I don't know the people anyway. And, of course, the nature of doing a study is I wouldn't go back to the people. So it's true that people will be scrutinized and that it would be possible for me to identify that reader 17 did something differently. But I won't. But that will never be connected back to who reader 17 was. It's worth some thought in thinking about how else to do this.
So I liked what you did with your broad definition of underrepresented groups. When I've done that, I've found some big differences between at least in terms of students, not necessarily applicants, who have only one of those characteristics versus those who have all of them. Right. Did you disaggregate that and find any differences between those groups?
I did a little bit of disaggregation of that. The problem is the sample sizes get too small to do this kind of regression discontinuity analysis. Mm-hmm. If you start to, even this group of pulling all of them together is on the low side for doing this. I think by being able to kind of look within a student and get the score with and without, I'll get a lot more precision and mm-hmm. it'll be more possible to do that. I couldn't get any information out of that with these data.
So two questions. Sure. One, did you look at all at whether the being asked for a letter changes conversion rates between admits and showing up? Does kind of the activation of maybe I'm going to Berkeley do anything? And then the second question is, are you worried about the general changes on campus this year in terms of systems, buildings, et cetera, affecting the kind of grade piece of the new admits?
So I didn't look at conversion rates. And the reason is that if we think that admissions, that letters affect who gets admitted, then I'm not comparing like to like by looking at yield among the admits. So I didn't do that except as a way of trying to come up with it. This might be a somewhat cleaner way of measuring who was actually admitted. So I don't know what the numbers are. There wasn't a big effect on conversion rates if you did that and ignore that issue, I think. Greg?
I mean, it's sort of the RUs are fairly stable over time, especially when the California residents older, all of them 43-44%. We can see scalings in income, API, and a whole range of other things. So that's, in a way, a good thing because it helps us do good enrollment modeling. But I don't know if it's possible.
Am I worried about grades being less informative this year than in other years? I don't know. I mean, there's always changes. I'm more worried about the fact that grades are a pretty limited measure of what counts as a good admit. But I don't have a better way of doing it.
I might have missed this, but what about across colleges?
You missed it because I didn't say it. So one of the challenges is that we don't actually have one admissions process. We have several. And in particular, engineering and chemistry are pretty different from some of the others, if I'm remembering that right, at least engineering. I did do this conditioning on which college you were in. And I think some of the analyses I did just for letters in science. And it didn't wildly change the story. The probability of admissions for somebody with a given set of characteristics is very different in those different schools. But the impact of the letter request doesn't seem to have been wildly different in those different places. Again, samples are small, so I don't want to push that too far.
Just a quick question. This is all for California residents. Did it look any different for non-residents?
I didn't look at non-residents. In part, I never quite pinned down what we'd done with non-residents. Did we ask for letters from non-residents also? Okay. So I just didn't look at them. That seemed like a dimension that was likely to be changing pretty dramatically from one year to the next, and I just didn't look at it. It's something we can do this coming year.
So I have a question, Jesse, about the role of the models, both the model that you use to predict admission and then also the one that admissions use to identify people to ask letters, because mm-hmm. if you just do a straight regression of all of the various factors that we have in an application file, including things like family income or parent education level or whatever, mm-hmm. Factors that are associated with disadvantage, like low income or low parent education, would be aligned with a lower likelihood of admission. Because they are highly correlated with all kinds of other factors. But in our stated admission policy, those things are supposed to be considered as positives. And so I don't understand how that works when you're creating your model. I mean, presumably you're just observing, but I would worry that it might end up understating the likelihood of admission for a student that has characteristics that are positively recognized in the admissions process, but negatively correlated with your likelihood of having high GPA or SAT scores.
So just to be clear, this model is a regression. So what it's trying to estimate is the difference between underrepresented and non-underrepresented student, or a low-income and non-low-income student, controlling for SAT and GPA and things like that. And so for many students, actually, the low income is positively correlated with the admissions outcome, conditional on all those other things, because we're already controlling for all those other things that it's negatively correlated with.
Okay. What about...
Now, the model was very, very flexible, both the model that I used and the one I stole it from, the model that they had used to predict last year's Reed scores. And so there are some low-income students for whom their combination of other numbers meant that low-income was positively associated with the probability of admission, and others for whom it was negatively associated. So there's no single effect of low-income on these things in the model. Let me say two other things about the role of the model. One, the model that I made to predict outcomes was just to help me understand this distribution. It obviously didn't play a role in admissions because it was made 6 months later, but
no,
also
but
didn't play a role in the model.
You're using it to make conclusions about the differences between the outcomes with the letters and the outcomes that might have happened without the letters.
No, I'm not. I'm only using the predicted Reed score from the model that was used to select on the letters. And in this model, a high number or a low number isn't what you wanted to be asked for letters. What you wanted was a middle number. And so even if there's some characteristic that tends to raise everybody's, that's going to push some people into letters and push some people out of letters in this process, because we're only asking the middle. It's a very unusual enterprise. We don't usually select the middle of a predicted outcome distribution, but in this case we did. And so even if there were some characteristic that pushed everybody's predicted Reed score this way, kind of downward, made it worse, that would push some people from here into being asked for letters and push some other people from here into not being asked for letters. I suppose I could ask, I could zero out all the disadvantage and ask what would people's chance of being asked for letters have been? Would for everybody who was a disadvantaged, would they have been asked for letters if they weren't disadvantaged? That's a question we could have asked in this. If everything else was the same about them but not disadvantaged, I don't actually know which way that would go, but I suspect it wouldn't have much of an impact at all. Does that answer the question? Yeah.
Still thinking.
Okay.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question of either you or Greg about the UCLA-Berkeley comparison. Some of the concern about the changes in Berkeley process stem from that comparison. UCLA has become just as selective, if not now more so, than Berkeley, even though the diversity numbers are quite superior to Berkeley's on most of the dimensions that you've talked about. Now, your findings show pretty convincingly that the letters of recommendation and also in your paper, Augmented Review, didn't seem to make much of a difference in the diversity of Berkeley admissions. So the question arises, what accounts for the difference? And there are three things. Of course, we could look for differences in application rates, differences in selection process itself, as you're studying here, and differences in yield. Mm-hmm. Given UCLA's proximity to the large minority population in the LA basin, they've had obvious advantages on the first and the third with application rates as well as yield rates amongst underrepresented minorities. It's unclear how much of the differences is really attributable to differences in their selection processes. At least what you can observe from the outside is they're not all that much different. So I guess what I'd like to know, it's unfair to ask you to make that comparison because I know you don't have the UCLA campus data. But I would be interested, based on what your analysis of the Berkeley data has showed so far, where you suspect the biggest bottleneck may be to admission of students of color. Is it admission, or is it application? Is it admission selection, or is it yield? And which has the greatest potential to expand enrollment of students of color?
Okay. There's a lot of pieces of that. Let me try to take a couple of them. One thing we know from Patrick's work here and from others is that people are overwhelmingly likely to go to the closest college to them. That most students go to the closest college, and the closest, if the basin for which UCLA is close, is a much more diverse population than the basin for which Berkeley is close. That's just a fact about California geography, by almost any measure we would care about. And so I think in any kind of diversity metric, UCLA is going to have a big advantage in that sense. I didn't look at UCLA comparisons at all. I only had data from Berkeley. I couldn't have looked at UCLA comparisons. I only compared 2015 to 2016. My interpretation is that, in fact, the decline in diversity at Berkeley between 2015 and 2016 is a statistical mirage. And it's coming from the wait list. It's coming from the fact that there were students who were disadvantaged, who have very low yield rates if we admit them, who in 2015 we would have admitted them, and in 2016 we offered them a spot on the wait list. And they said no to the wait list, and so we didn't count them as an admit. In 2015 we would have counted them as an admission who didn't show up. It's the same student, they made the same decisions, everything was the same, except we just relabeled them. And my interpretation is that that's the biggest part of the change from 2015 to 2016. I can't prove that because I don't know what would have happened for any individual under other regimes. I don't have a nice regression discontinuity, but I do think that's a big part of it. In terms of what margin makes the most difference if we wanted to increase the underrepresented minority share at this university, I think there's lots of different ways of asking that question that lead to different answers. I mean, what would make the most difference in society is improving the family background and schools of these kids and making sure that they were more nurtured throughout their lives. And then they would have stronger applications when they got to be 17 years old, and then we would admit them with higher probability. That's obviously a hard thing to do. If we're only allowed to implement it through the admissions process, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And yeah.
So now I feel compelled to answer Saul's question. Full disclosure, I'm from the Office of the President, Nina Robinson. We did look, Saul, at the common applicants between UCLA and UC Berkeley this year. So we pulled out College of Letters and Science only. So we removed engineering and we removed chemistry and we removed all the other colleges. We just looked at letters and science. And we looked at common applicants. So, and I don't have the numbers on me, but there were maybe 15,000 of them or something like that. And in that pool of 15,000 applicants to the College of Letters and Science at Berkeley, who had also applied to UCLA, overall, the admit rate for students in that common group was lower at UCLA than it was at Berkeley. So for those applicants, Berkeley was less selective than UCLA. And of course, Berkeley is not less selective overall, but it has a skewed pool. It's skewed toward the high end. And this didn't skew. This was the exact same applicants. And fewer of them were likely to be admitted to UCLA. But the admit rates for underrepresented students from that group were much higher at UCLA than they were at Berkeley. There was a significant difference, which tells me that every single part of the process needs to be examined, because I totally agree that application rates from people in Southern California favor UCLA in terms of minorities. Yield presumably does as well. There may be all kinds of other things, but I think that the evidence that we have based on simple descriptive statistics seems to indicate that the same student going through the admissions process at Berkeley versus the admissions process at UCLA, if they're underrepresented, they have a better chance relative to non-underrepresented students. So there's still a gap, right? This underrepresented students are still less likely to be admitted at UCLA than the non-underrepresented, but the gap between groups is much smaller at UCLA than it is at Berkeley. So something else is going on there, too.
Yeah, I want to just respond, and I want to let Greg respond to that, because I would love to see those data and play with them, because I think there are lots of interesting questions about why that is. And I one of the things I would be worried about or think might be going on in these is that each of these campuses builds relationships with local schools, we're going to know more about applicants from local schools than we are from applicants farther away, and that may be part of the story and could affect the relative admissions probabilities even for common applicants.
So I think we really owe Jesse a great bit of gratitude for that. So two final points again. Remember, coming attractions next Tuesday, Lonnie Hancock and Carol Liu on legislative process and public higher education and funding of public higher education in the Matrix, 8th floor, Barrows, 3 o'clock next Tuesday. And secondly, again, we shatter the image that there's no free lunch. It's right out there. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.